Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Gastrointestinal Stromal Tumors, or GIST, and it's a treatment update on GIST. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and in particular also with GIST organizations, LifeRaft Group, particularly GIST Cancer Research Fund and GIST Support International. So, we have wonderful speakers today, and it's a very special time. You'll hear later that this is part of GIST Awareness Day, which will be on July 13th. So this is part of the events and programming around that. Now, I want to first of all acknowledge all of you on the call today. We have over 475 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Russia, Tunisia, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by Bayer Healthcare, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. I'd like to take a moment and turn your attention to the materials that we received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about all of the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you with their 800 numbers and websites. There is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing. And there also is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask all of you to take a moment at the very end of the program today, or even during the program if you wish, and complete that evaluation form. And when you think about it, you are really the best people to tell us the programming that we should be offering on GIST, the topics you'd like to have addressed, other topics you'd like us to offer as well. So take a moment, tell us what you'd like, and we try very hard to implement your suggestions. Indeed, today's program is one that was really in response to many of you asking us to do a program on GIST, so that I really appreciate your really taking that time. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Heinrich, and Dr. Heinrich is professor of medicine and cell and developmental biology, hematology and medical oncology, Argonne Health and Science University, section chief, hematology and medical oncology, Portland VA MC. And Dr. Heinrich is going to present an overview of gastrointestinal stromal tumors. He's going to present a summary of their treatment and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Heinrich.
It is my pleasure to participate in today's Cancer Care Workshop. I will be providing over the next few minutes an overview of GIST. To facilitate an understanding of GIST, I've organized my presentation around the lines of the 10 most common questions that patients address to me when I'm consulting with them about their GIST. So question number one is, what is a GIST? So GIST is short for gastrointestinal stromal tumor, which is a form of sarcoma. Sarcomas are cancers of cells known as connective tissue, which are the specialized cells that hold organs together. So we think of the liver for all that it does, but without the connective tissue to hold the liver together, it would fall apart and be of no use. So GISTs are sarcoma that arise in the GI tract, most commonly in the stomach, but can also arise in the small intestine or the large intestine. Patients with GISTs can present either with disease at the site where it started, like a stomach tumor only, or they could present with a stomach tumor as well as disease that spread, which we call metastatic disease. So another common question, which is the second question about GIST, is how common is GIST? So in the United States, we believe that there are about 6,000 to 7,000 new patients diagnosed each year with GIST. Because our treatments have improved so much for GIST, the number of patients in the United States who have had a diagnosis of GIST is increasing. It's difficult to estimate, but it may be as high as 50 to 70,000. We're not really sure. Question three, what are the different types of GIST? So we originally thought about 14 years ago, there was only one type of GIST. But then as we were able to analyze the tumors and figure out what was wrong in them, we realized that there actually are many types of GIST, and there may be as many as 20 different types. We usually think of the different types based on the type of DNA defect that's present in the tumor. So 80% of GIST have a mutation of a protein called KIT, K-I-T. About 5 to 10% have mutations of a related protein that's abbreviated PDGFRA. And 10 to 15% of GIST don't have either a KIT mutation or a PDGFRA mutation. We used to call them wild type, which is a genetic term meaning nothing's wrong, but it's not true because these are tumors. And we know that these so-called wild type tumors actually are not one type of tumor, and there may be up to 10 types of wild type tumors. So increasingly as we go into the future, knowing exactly what type of GIST the patient has is very important to treatment. Now, question four is a pretty natural question when somebody's been diagnosed with something is, what caused this? And in terms of GIST, generally there is not any precipitating cause that we can identify. It does not seem related to particularly to age, to gender, to the country that you live in, race, ethnicity, occupation, chemical exposure. It seems to be truly a random event that happens in some people. And in the United States, it happens about 5,000 to 7,000 times per year. The one exception to this is that there are a subset of patients, maybe a couple percent of all GIST patients, who have something known as the Carney-Stratakis syndrome. This is a syndrome in which you inherit a susceptibility to developing a GIST. And in fact, patients with this type of inherited mutation have a 70 to 80% chance in their lifetime of developing a GIST or another type of benign tumor called a paraganglioma. The reason I emphasize this is that these tumors in individuals can be detected at an early curable stage using routine medical diagnostic methods such as endoscopy, MRI, or blood work. Importantly, once you identify such a patient, then their children, their brothers and sisters, their parents, their aunts and uncles, all those that relate through the family tree have a 50% chance that they inherited the condition, and that can be tested for using a blood specimen. So you can imagine that this quickly becomes a pretty large problem for a family who has lots of siblings and children. Now, the fifth question is, how do patients with GIST present? And there really are four common ways that patients with GIST present. Actually, one of the most common ways is that you are having endoscopy of your stomach because your doctor thinks you have reflux or possibly an ulcer, and the endoscopist finds a GIST on endoscopy. Another common way that patients present is that they have a low blood count related to iron deficiency, or the doctor finds that they have blood in their stool, so they're bleeding somewhere in the GI tract, and during the workup, the GIST is diagnosed. The least common way that GIST patients present is that they actually present with abdominal pain or symptoms related to their GIST. And the final way patients present, which is actually, again, surprisingly common, is that your doctor does a CT scan or an ultrasound for some reason, like trying to figure out if you have gallstones or a kidney stone, and they find a GIST by accident, which had nothing to do with why the doctor ordered the test, but it is discovered. Question six relates to question five is, well, how do we figure out it's a GIST? How do we diagnose it? So the only way that we can diagnose GIST is to get a piece of it and look at it under the microscope and figure out that it's a GIST as opposed to something else like a lymphoma or some other type of cancer. The ways that we could get a piece of tissue to analyze would be, if it's in your stomach, it's easy and safe for an endoscopist to look down the stomach with the scope and do a biopsy of the tumor. If that's not possible, then patients could have a biopsy done in a CT scanner where the radiologist looks at where the mass is and puts a biopsy needle in there. Or some patients have a more emergent need because they're having significant bleeding and go to surgery, not knowing what the diagnosis is, but we figure it out after the surgery. In any of these scenarios, it's very important that you have an experienced pathologist look at the case. Just nowadays is usually a straightforward diagnosis, but it can be rather tricky, and as other speakers like Dr. Dimitri will address, our medical therapy works very well for GIST, and the same therapies do not work for other cancers that look like GIST but which are not GIST, and so you really want to have the diagnosis correct. It's important that your pathologist be able to do modern immunohistochemistry to make a diagnosis. Otherwise, you may be misdiagnosed, and that could lead to significant delays in appropriate treatment. The seventh question is, if I have a localized GIST, like a GIST in my stomach, what is the treatment? Well, the treatment is to remove it by surgery, and surgery is the only known curative treatment for GIST. If you have a small to moderate-sized tumor, then we generally go to surgery right away. If your tumor is very large, such as more than 10 centimeters, which is about 4 inches, or in a very complicated location, it may not be possible or desirable to do surgery right away, and in that case, you may need to take some pill treatments, such as imatinib or Gleevec, to shrink the tumor so that the surgery would be made easier. And Dr. Dimitri will talk more about the medical treatments. One of the most important things about surgery is after the tumor is removed that it be correctly analyzed by a pathologist. Now, we're used to in situations like a polyp in your colon or a lump in your breast that's biopsied for the pathologist to say it's benign or it's malignant. In GIST, we can't say that because the tumors all look the same, and ones that never come back look the same as those that are doomed to come back. And so instead of saying something is benign or malignant, we really make a risk assessment and offer a probability such as low risk or high risk, or give a number like it's a 50% risk of recurrence in the next 5 years, or it's a 2% risk of recurrence, or it's a 90%. And the way that we do that is to look at where the tumor started, like the stomach, how big was the tumor, and then something that the pathologist needs to carefully measure, which is called the mitotic index. An assessment of the mitotic index in GIST is increasingly straightforward, but it's super important, and not all pathologists may do this correctly, especially at smaller hospitals, which don't see very many GIST or sarcoma cases. And the reason that we make such a big point about the risk assessment is it's been shown that for some people who have a risk of recurrence which is felt to be too high, that if they take up to 3 years of imatinib or Gleevec after the surgery, then that this will decrease the chance that the tumor will come back. On the other hand, some patients have a tumor with a very low risk of recurrence, like 2 or 4%, in which case taking 3 years of a pill treatment might not be of any particular medical benefit. Question eight is, I've had my surgery, they got it all, how do we see if the tumor is going to come back or not? Well, the only way to do that is to do some type of imaging, either a CT scan or an MRI. We're still trying to figure out our exact guidelines, but patients need to be followed for many years after surgery. We usually start out with doing a scan every 6 months. At some point, after 3 to 5 years, we go down to a scan once per year, and as we get further out, eventually we stop doing scans altogether, although we don't know really when is the safe stopping point. Should we stop at 6 years or should we stop at 10 years? We're still trying to figure it out. The ninth question is, what happens if it comes back? How is that treatable? In most cases, when tumors come back in the case of GIST, then it's not optimal to do surgery, although that sometimes is a consideration. Instead, we treat them with medical therapy, using inhibitors that target what's wrong in GIST. So back to the beginning, I talked about KIT mutations or PDGFRA mutations. Those are the rogue enzymes that power the cells and make the cells grow. Normal cells do not require those rogue enzymes, and using specialized drugs like imatinib, also known as Gleevec, sunitinib, also known as Sutent, or regorafenib, also known as Stivarga, we can target those rogue enzymes and inhibit the growth of the GIST cells. And Dr. Dimitri will talk more about the medical therapy of GIST in his session. So the final question, which really maybe should be the first question because I think it's one of the most important, is how do I find my GIST team? So in my view, it's very important that you identify a team of doctors that can help you passage through your GIST experience. So one suggestion I would offer is interview your doctor. How many patients does GIST, does that doctor treat? How familiar with it is it? Is he or she with GIST? The average medical oncologist in the United States probably has 0 to 2 GIST patients. So they may not be extremely familiar with it, and in interviewing them or discussing your questions and concerns, you may sense that they don't know the answers to all of your questions. So what to do about that? Well, I would suggest a couple things that are available online. One is through patient advocacy online resources, you can find lists of GIST centers or GIST doctors, which are recommended by other GIST patients. These resources include the LifeRaft group, which the president, Mr. Scherzer, will be talking later during this workshop, but there also are GIST Support International or GIST Cancer Research Fund. Another good way to find a GIST doctor is to look online at a website called clinicaltrials.gov, which is a list of clinical trials, and try to find those centers performing GIST clinical studies because they actually or usually have GIST specialists. And the things you might want to interview or consider in choosing your GIST team would be, does wherever I'm going, do they have adequate pathology and molecular diagnostic resources to accurately classify and diagnose my GIST? How familiar is the center with GIST? Are there surgeons available who can perform surgery if necessary? And are there radiologists that are used to seeing CT scans or MRIs of GIST patients? So I hope in these 10 questions that I provided a little bit of an overview of GIST for you, and that will lead into the topics to be covered by the other speakers of this during this workshop. And at this point, I will turn it back to Carolyn Messner as our moderator to introduce the subsequent speakers.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Heinrich. That was really most informative, outstanding overview of GIST and its treatments, and thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. George Dimitri. Dr. Dimitri is Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Director, Ludwig Center at Harvard. And Dr. Dimitri is going to address new treatment approaches, including the role of targeted therapy, how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, and pain and symptom management. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Dimitri.
Thank you, Carolyn, and hello, everybody. Thanks for joining today. I, too, would like to thank Dr. Heinrich for just an exceptionally complete introduction to this disease and take over what he told me to take over, which is the medical treatment of GIST. GIST, as many of you know, has become kind of a poster child for the revolution in oncology that we've seen over the last decade and a half or so, where we've moved from sort of brute force chemotherapy, which occasionally helped a lot of people. Chemotherapy cures Hodgkin's disease, cures many women with breast cancer, can cure leukemia and many other diseases like testis cancer. But chemotherapy for many common diseases and uncommon diseases like GIST was essentially useless. So the targeted therapies that Dr. Heinrich referred to are the smart drugs that understood that GIST is driven by these, basically these confused enzymes, these mutated enzymes called kinases, most commonly KIT. About 3/4 of patients with GIST will have a mutation in that KIT enzyme. And that locks the KIT in an on position, and the cell survives and continues to grow and accumulates, and that's the fundamental root cause of the disease. So the smart therapy would therefore shut off the short circuit in KIT, disconnect the KIT from the cell, and frankly, all of our body cells have very nice defense mechanisms so that if they realize they're mutated, they can actually destroy themselves as a protection for each of us as an individual organism. And that's what happens. If you give a GIST cell imatinib or sunitinib or regorafenib, and it's actually shutting off that kinase, the cell, after a day or two, will actually destroy itself. So that was the great discovery many years ago that we attribute to our Japanese colleagues who figured out that GIST is driven by these mutations in these rogue enzymes. And then it was a hop, skip, and a jump to take a drug that was originally developed, believe it or not, for cardiovascular disease. It was developed for keeping cardiac stents open, and that drug is now known as imatinib. It was never really developed in cardiovascular work, but it was first developed as a leukemia treatment for the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia, because that kind of leukemia is also driven by a different rogue enzyme. But the same drug, imatinib, can also shut down this rogue enzyme, KIT, in GIST. And many of you know just the wonderful stories that came, that started in the year 2000 when the very first GIST patient was treated in Finland and the second GIST patient treated in Boston and the fifth and sixth in Oregon and Philadelphia. It was just an extraordinary experience to watch people who previously had just terrible, life-threatening, untreatable cancer go into these massive remissions. And many, many are still alive today. We are pleased now that we've had more than 14 years of experience with these kinase-inhibiting drugs to see about a quarter of patients with very far advanced GIST still survive more than 14 years later. And what's also exciting is that we have several drug options for patients. It's not just imatinib. There are two other drugs with the participation of, frankly, the world investigator community, as well as the world's patient community. The patients have been wonderful supporters of research, and without the patient participation as partners in these research studies, we never could have proven the benefit of imatinib or sunitinib or regorafenib to the level of proof required by the U.S. FDA and other FDA-type regulatory agencies around the world. But right now, these three drugs are all approved for the treatment of advanced or metastatic GIST because they have been shown to control the disease. And that's the important thing. In far advanced GIST, there's treatment. And usually what we do in cancer medicine, if we have something that controls metastatic or spread or advanced disease, we try to move it earlier to try to prevent the disease, if it's localized, from ever coming back. And that's the other great development. Under the leadership of Dr. Ron DiMatteo at Memorial Sloan Kettering and many, many collaborative centers across the country, we and others have shown that imatinib can actually prevent and delay the recurrence of GIST if it's detected as a single lump before it's spread. And our colleagues in Finland and Germany then did a second study to say how long should imatinib be given after that first surgery to prevent the disease from coming back. And what they found was that 3 years of imatinib after that first surgery for limited disease is better than 1 year of imatinib. We really don't know the optimal duration of how long to give imatinib after that first surgery, but the standard of care across the world, even in the very cost-conscious United Kingdom, which really has not liked to spend money on drugs unless they're really effective and really help people, even there, it's accepted that 3 years of imatinib for the patients at high risk of having GIST come back after the first surgery is a very reasonable and appropriate thing to do, and that represents the standard of care. The open question, if somebody has a very high-risk GIST, that it is at high risk of coming back, should the imatinib ever be stopped? We are doing a study here with many other centers across the world to give the imatinib for 5 years, which we fully expect would be better than 3 years. And so it goes. We actually don't know. One of the key discussions to have with a doctor who knows something about GIST, as Dr. Heinrich said before, is how long should I be on the imatinib if I do not have metastatic disease and if I'm only taking the imatinib as a prevention therapy, as what we call an adjuvant therapy after that very first surgery. But now let's move to the situation of the subset of people who might have the disease come back, even despite having trying the imatinib, let's say, for 3 years, waiting a year or two, and then the disease comes back. So at that point, the standard across the world, again, is to start by giving the drug therapy with imatinib as a single agent. As it turns out, imatinib was the first drug to be developed for GIST, and it's still the easiest one for patients to take. It's rather selective against which enzymes it shuts down, so it has the best tolerability profile, meaning that patients, even though they have some side effects, like perhaps some diarrhea and some puffiness around the eyes and some ability to hold on to fluid, so feel a little puffy, even though it has side effects, it does not have as many side effects typically as sunitinib or regorafenib, the two drugs that came later. So imatinib is virtually always the starting point for the treatment of advanced or metastatic GIST. And about half of the patients will have the imatinib work and control the disease for around 2 years, which means that half of those patients will lose control of disease in those first 2 years and have to switch to a second drug. But half of the patients may have control of the disease for much longer than 2 years. And what we're finding is about 10 to 15% of patients are still controlled just with imatinib 14 years later. We don't know who those lucky patients are or what makes their GIST different from another patient's GIST where the disease loses control, although we have some sense that it's due to the DNA mutations itself. As Dr. Heinrich said, there are probably more than 50 different types of GIST, and only a few of them really require a different type of treatment based on what the DNA problem is in the GIST itself. And when I say the DNA problem, I mean whether it has a mutation and what type of a mutation it has. The key element here is a group of patients with GIST who are called exon 9 mutants in GIST. Now, exon is a part of the gene, and every gene has a certain number of exons. It actually has about 18 exons, so somewhere right in the middle is exon 9. And if a GIST has a mutation in exon 9, it actually has a higher propensity to require a higher dose of imatinib to control it. In other words, the standard dose is 400 milligrams per day, but people can take up to 800 milligrams per day and actually do pretty well with that. Studies have shown that the exon 9 KIT mutant GIST is actually better controlled at 800 milligrams per day than 400 milligrams per day. So does that mean that everybody with exon 9 mutant GIST who has advanced disease needs to be on 800? Well, not necessarily. Many patients choose to start on 400 and then switch to the 800 later if the disease starts to grow. Other patients may choose to start at the 800 right off if they're tolerating it very well. That's a decision, and there are many decisions to be made with your doctor, and that's important as well. Doctors have to have a certain amount of experience in this disease to make even the simplest decisions like that. Now that we see so many GIST patients living longer than ever, most community oncologists have some patients with GIST, but they may not have a lot of experience with GIST management. But that's why the expert centers exist. We're here in many ways both to design the next generation clinical research to make treatments better, but also to help our brethren in the community to make the best possible decision. So we work in a consultative way commonly with patients who are primarily cared for by their local oncologist, but sometimes even these key first decisions, do I start at the low dose of Gleevec or do I have to take the high dose, that may in and of itself be worth a consultation with a group of doctors who see, let's say, more than 100 or 200 GIST patients a year. At Dana-Farber, we see something on the order of 300 to 500 GIST patients per year. So that gives you a sense of the experience base that our center has, that Memorial Sloan Kettering has, Oregon, Fox Chase, MD Anderson, all of the big centers like that have a lot of experience, and we work with our colleagues in the community. Now, I was given also the task of talking about clinical trials because without clinical trials, we never could have developed imatinib, and then subsequently sunitinib. Sunitinib is a terrific drug. It kind of got a bad reputation in the early days because it does have more side effects than imatinib, but the body knows how to compensate for that. And after a few weeks on treatment, virtually everybody can tolerate the sunitinib. And fortunately, sunitinib amazingly shuts down the second mutation, which is something that the cancer cells can develop over time and become resistant to imatinib. And most of those will develop a mutation in exon 13, where the imatinib typically binds, and that new mutation in exon 13 basically prevents the imatinib from shutting off the rogue enzyme. Fortunately, sunitinib can bind to the original mutation as well as to this new exon 13 mutation, so it can shut down the rogue enzyme. Patients get benefit again. That benefit on average is about 9 months, but again, in some people it can go for years. In other people it may be less than 9 months. We knew that. We figured out why the sunitinib worked, and that's where we started working on the third drug, which is known as regorafenib. Now, regorafenib similarly shuts down a type of the enzymes that neither imatinib nor sunitinib can shut down. These mutations are in exon 17. And regorafenib is much better than we originally expected at shutting down exon 17. So you see where we're going. Imatinib is very good at shutting down exon 11 and at higher doses exon 9. Sunitinib takes care of all those, plus it's good at exon 13. And then you've got regorafenib, which gets most of those, plus exon 17. The problem is that what happens with that exon 13 that makes resistance to imatinib, it actually kind of makes resistance to regorafenib as well. So that's the basis for the latest clinical research trial here run by my colleague Suzanne George, the clinical director of our GIST Center, where we're actually alternating patients. 1 month taking regorafenib, which shuts down the exon 17, and the next month taking sunitinib, which shuts down the exon 13, and doing this in a ping-pong way based on some of the very innovative research work done by Jonathan Fletcher, our basic scientist here at Harvard, doing many of the research studies that have led to the development of these three drugs. Finally, we are working with Dr. Heinrich, as well as many other places in the U.S., to develop yet another IB, an inhibitor of these kinases known as ponatinib. Ponatinib is very effective at shutting off resistance in the chronic myeloid leukemia that imatinib was originally developed against. And ponatinib is now in an exploratory study here in Boston, Philadelphia at Fox Chase, and at Oregon Health and Science University for GIST following failure of all three of these drugs that are standard, imatinib, sunitinib, and regorafenib. We don't know how good it will be. That work is still in progress, but at least there's another drug on the horizon. And then there are many other clinical trials now mixing and matching other drugs of different inhibitory classes to try to really get even better benefits for patients. So with that, I would encourage everybody to just always, like Dr. Heinrich said, feel comfortable with your healthcare team, interview them, discuss with them whether an expert consultation at a site that has great experience in GIST and has many clinical trials might be useful, not to take the patient away from the local doctor and add inconvenience, but simply to serve as a different resource. I often find this is also useful in terms of the nursing care. Even though I'm a doctor and Dr. Heinrich's a doctor, I want to stress the importance of expert nursing care, because especially when you get into the second and third generation drugs like sunitinib and regorafenib, we have found that these drugs are actually very well tolerated by patients as long as the patients have a terrific nurse or nurse practitioner working with them, somebody they feel comfortable with, where they can talk about side effects they may be getting with the drug and how to manage those side effects. We found that these side effects are perfectly manageable as long as the dosing of the drug is customized and personalized to that patient's individual tolerance. So I think that's the other advantage of an expert GIST center with lots of experience. Our nurses are terrific professionals who work in partnership both with the doctors as well as with the patients to optimize their care. And that's my final point. The supportive care of patients with GIST, now that most patients are living longer than ever before in human history, is a key point. And we want everybody to live as long as possible and with the highest possible quality of life. That's a key element of our whole care plan. while we're working with research studies to figure out how to get closer to cure every day. I'm not giving up on the possibility of curing patients with GIST once we start developing new combination therapies, but we're still just in our infancy of learning how to do that. And in the meantime, our role is to really make people feel as good as possible and have them live as long as possible. And that's where this partnership between patients and their medical and nursing care team is so key, because there are so many ways, simple tricks of having patients tolerate the drugs, tolerate even the surgeries in the best possible way so that it's not a fear-inducing thing, but it becomes commonplace. Just like for diabetics who learn to stay on insulin their whole life and live a perfectly good quality of life, that's our role now while we're in this research phase of trying to figure out how to take GIST care one step further and start curing people more than we have so far. So with that, I too will pass this back to Carolyn and go back into quiet mode until the questions come. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tamimi. That was really outstanding, just really wonderful presentation. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Mr. Norman Scherzer. And Mr. Scherzer is Executive Director of the LifeRaft Group, and he's going to tell you about the LifeRaft Group's free support programs, as well as the upcoming GIST Awareness Day on Sunday, July 13, 2014. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Scherzer.
Thank you, Carolyn. I should, however, by saying that when both Drs. Heinrich and Dimitri spoke about patients who've been on Gleevec for 14 years, that one of those patients is my wife. And one of the reasons the LifeRaft Group exists today is that my wife was the original patients who responded to this drug in such a magnificent way. So the LifeRaft Group was formed at a kitchen table, like a lot of patient organizations. Our focus is on survival. We have a pretty comprehensive mix of activities that we support. We have a number of support groups, both online and in person. We try to turn out cutting-edge medical and scientific information. We do it through a newsletter, through our website. And starting this year, we actually published the first cancer research journal and have since turned out two editions. We have a patient registry, and we have a tissue bank that help us track how patients are doing, particularly label drugs, until they can get into a clinical trial. We just finished an expert patient training program. We had 9 sign up for a 6-week, 30-hour program to turn into expert patients, patients who can advocate for themselves, patients who can help other patients, patients who can volunteer. And what's interesting about this is it's kind of symbolic of this program today. That is that the world has changed a great deal, and what we see today is not a physician in one room and a patient sitting off in a corner, but people like my colleagues, George Dimitri, working with patients in a collaborative way. And George and I have been working together now for all these 14 years that my wife has been diagnosed. We have something new we just sponsored with the National Institute of Health, and that is the first virtual pediatric tumor board. And we've done that for a number of reasons, one of which is the government cut back their funding, unfortunately, for the in-person clinics at NIH. But the other is because not everybody can reach the NIH, and we wanted to come up with a vehicle that would help us reach physicians and patients who wild type and pediatric GIST and can't get to an expert center but need opinion. And then we have our research team. George mentioned Jonathan Fletcher, who's the head of the LifeRaft Group research team. What's unique about this team is it's a group of 10 best in the world, laboratory-based research. And what they've agreed to do as a team is to collect, to actually share information and not to compete, and to work together in an extraordinarily synergistic way. And then coming up, we have our first GIST Day. It's on Sunday, July the 13th. And why the 13th? Because some very smart person on our staff figured out that there are 13 new GIST patients diagnosed today in the United States. And this was part of a program with regard to Rare Disease Day. And as part of this this day, we have a number of collaborative programs in Miami and in Chicago and on the West Coast. And I guess the last point I'd make is that what we offer people is hope. Cancer is like a stone that's thrown in water, and you watch the ripple effects of it. It affects many, many people, but it mostly affects people's families and so on. And we hope that we're helping the families as well as the patients. So back to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Scherzer, for a really an excellent presentation and really for your the dedicated work of LifeRaft Group and for you and your wife's inspiration to forming LifeRaft Group and for all the work that you do. Thank you. Thank you very much. And also for highlighting the GIST Awareness Day on July 13th. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's coordinator of our older adult services. And Ms. Kelly will be addressing stress management tips and Cancer Care's free psychosocial services provided by professionally trained oncology social workers. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And I'd like to thank everyone on the call. I think we've gotten such wonderful information today. So as Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people diagnosed with GIST and their loved ones. You know, today we've been talking about GIST, managing your care, quality of life, and I'd like to begin really by speaking about the importance of managing your stress as part of your care. Having a diagnosis of GIST can be stressful. You know, we've been talking about the unique aspects of GIST. It's a rarer cancer, a more chronic cancer. And, you know, it's figuring out some of those tips, tools you can use to get you through it and really to improve your quality of life. And I know it's not possible to eliminate all sources of stress, but there are some things you can do to help yourself. So I'm going to start with just some very practical tips you can use. The first one, and actually this is across the board for everyone to use, check in with yourself. I really think it's something we don't all do that often, but, you know, ask yourself, how am I feeling? Am I feeling stressed? Am I feeling it emotionally? Am I feeling it physically? You know, our bodies respond to physical and emotional stress by releasing stress hormones. And when those go out, your blood pressure goes up, your heart rate goes up, blood sugar levels go up. So check in, listen to your body. It really will let you know kind of where you are with things. Also, be aware of your limits. How are you feeling once you've done that? You know, are you feeling able to engage in activities? Are you having difficulty with energy? Allow yourself to say no. That's often a difficult thing, but really say no when people ask you to take on a task that you feel like you don't have time or energy to complete. Get organized. And this one, you know, I know some of us struggle more than others with this, but use a calendar, create a list of tasks, break things down so they're more manageable. You know, focus on just one thing at a time before you move to the next. And concentrate your efforts on things you can control. You know, a good example is, you know, a doctor's schedule or being stuck in traffic. I think we've all been there. Even with the best planning, it happens. And I think sometimes the only aspect of a problem you can control is how you react to it. So, you know, engaging in some flexibility with it, because if you can do that, your stress levels may lower, may stay down. Ask for help. And this is something I know that we've been talking about a little bit, but, you know, asking family, friends, health professionals, you know, this is such an important thing to do. You know, there's organizations out there, LifeRaft, you know, your medical team, ask for help, whether it's specific meals, tasks, groceries, that type of thing, or support for counseling groups. All of these things can alleviate stress. And then I do want to talk a little bit about just financial stress, because that can be a huge piece of this too. If you're having difficulty financially with medical bills, day-to-day expenses, all the things that kind of come along with this, ask an oncology social worker, a financial advisor who's familiar with cancer for advice on dealing with the cancer-related insurance and financial matters. Don't wait to seek financial help. And I say that because, you know, late bills, debt, all of that can add up quickly. There are things you can do to address it. So if you find yourself in that situation, definitely, definitely reach out for help. And then some other sort of practical tips for the stress management, and you may hear these from your doctors and other health professionals, exercising, adequate sleep, healthy diet, social activities, you know, going out, having fun, laughing, and engaging also just in activities you enjoy, whether it's hobbies or clubs and that type of thing. And then last but not least, relaxation techniques. So really simple things you can do, regulating your breathing, slowing your breathing down. Other relaxation techniques could include meditation, visualization where you imagine yourself in a calming place. And these can really kind of practiced on a day-to-day basis can do all of those things like lower your blood pressure, slow your heart rate, you know, reduce muscle tension, lower fatigue. It can improve your concentration. And the real key with relaxation is learning to relax. And I stress the word learning. It's a skill, relaxation, and it takes time to develop, and it's something to practice. So if you're looking for relaxation techniques, the Internet is a great resource. There's a lot on there. Also, talk to your medical team. A lot of the time they've got really good resources on that. And then also sometimes they have classes, that type of thing you can do in workshops. So, you know, that's definitely something to keep in mind. And, you know, I want to go back actually to asking for help, and I'm going to talk a little bit about cancer care and how we can, you know, be a part of your support network and be a place you can go to for help. Just a little bit about who we are. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We provide that face-to-face in the New York area and over the phone nationally. We have support groups, also face-to-face in New York and over the phone nationally. We also have online groups. Those are national and international. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help, how to navigate the healthcare system. We also have some limited financial assistance available. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. And oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, we talked about financial demands, also physical changes with treatment, social adjustment, psychological impact, and overall care. I think that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with a diagnosis and treatment is an important part of the healing process, and I would actually add it in as part of your treatment, as part of that treatment plan. You know, if you join a support group, you're really connecting with others who are going through something similar. Individual counseling has a space, provides a space that's just yours to voice any concerns you may have, and the connections, I think, help lessen the isolation that you may experience going through this, whether you're a patient or a caregiver. Feeling well emotionally helps you be able to better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. We have a number of groups that we are currently providing. We have telephone groups for caregivers and patients, also face-to-face group, patient, caregiver, and, of course, the online groups have all of that, too. And if you're interested in any of our services, you can visit our website, and that's www.cancercare.org. All of our services, all of our publications, it's such a comprehensive website. There's so much information there, so you can check our website. You can also call us, and, you know, I definitely recommend checking in with us, giving us a call. All of our oncology social workers are here on the line, and you can call our HOPE line. It's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And so, you know, really, if you have questions from today's talks, you know, I know we've got a lot of information to digest and a lot to get our arms around, we can help you kind of understand what it means for you and your family. So, you know, I really want you to take home you're not alone in this. Our services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really excellent, excellent presentation, Sarah. Just wonderful, and wonderful resource for everybody as well. So thank you. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Kate to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and I'm also going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board so that we can all be here to address the questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone.
And we have a question actually for Dr. Dimitri from some of our actually online participants. I'm going to begin. One is, how do I select a surgeon? Will I have a better outcome from a surgeon who specializes in cancer surgery? Dr. Dimitri?
Boy, that is an important question and a controversial one, because even in surgery, there are general surgeons and there are surgical oncologists, and there is no real quality measure that distinguishes between them, although we tend to work most closely with surgical oncologists. I will say that there is a controversy there. So I think Dr. Heinrich's idea was a good one. Talk to your doctor. How many patients with this disease have they seen? Now, many of my patients have had some sort of emergency and they've needed a surgeon in some little town. That's life, you know, and I think you just move on from that. You couldn't predict it. You don't have time to interview someone, and that's okay. We'll deal with the sequelae. Don't worry about that. But when it is completely elective, it might be good just to ask, you know, have you ever seen this before? How many of these have you seen? One of my patients who went to a community hospital in the Boston area felt a little uncomfortable because after she had surgery, everybody on the staff was dropping by to look at her because they say, oh, we've never seen this disease called GIST before. We've read about it, but we've never seen it before. And that did not make her comfortable, as you could imagine. Nobody wants to feel like they're somehow the exceptional patient and they've never seen one before. So I think there is comfort in numbers. There is experience that lends itself to better outcomes, and I think that's the only way to do it. I can't say any more than that. And I want to be careful about the sometimes self-congratulatory nature of academic centers. I think there are some terrific, very busy, and very expert community centers which have a lot of experience. I just want to make that clear as well. I'm not your typical academic megalomaniacal person, but I do think that experience counts in this disease.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dimitri. And there's another question for you as well. And the question is, does the degree of tumor shrinkage from targeted cancer therapy provide any indication about my long-term prognosis?
Yeah, that is a great question. We don't really think so. And I think what's very clear about this is that many GISTs, even those that have terrific benefit in the long run, really don't shrink that much. They just stop growing. And that's the key thing. They stop growing. They look different on CAT scans. You can see that 98% of the tumor cells have given up the ghost and they just turn into water. But the tumor itself may not shrink that much. We're hot on the trail of how that is. If most of the tumor is gone, why is it about the same shape and the same size? That's an interesting research question, and that is in many ways standing between us and cure. So it's an important research question as well. But I think everybody's disease is different. Everybody's situation is different. So I also want to be careful when I answer these questions, I answer them in generalities. And I think your question is a very good one, but it really depends on your specific issues, where the disease is, and other things like that. So I won't speak specifically to that. In general, though, it really doesn't matter that much if it shrinks a lot or if it doesn't shrink that much, as long as it stops growing. That's the key.
Excellent. And, of course, we suggest you go back to your treating healthcare team as well. It's a good place to ask a question here. But then, as Dr. Dimitri has said, the doctor who specifically is treating you has more of the details. So, excellent. These are great questions. And we have another question from one of our telephone participants. Kate?
Our question comes from the line of Lisa L. Your line is open.
Yes. My name is Lisa L. I was diagnosed with GIST in February 14 of 2011. There was a mass inseparable from the uterus. I had a secondary surgery in January 25 of 2012 because now they found a mass by the ovary. GIST, treating with Gleevec. My question is to Dr. Heinrich regarding follow-up care. I have had PET scans annually. I believe you mentioned you needed CAT scans or MRIs every 6 months. That has not been the treatment of my local oncologist. What do you suggest? Is a PET scan appropriate?
Well, Lisa, thank you. That's an excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Dimitri if you would address that question. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, if you don't mind, let me handle that one. In the early days of imatinib and GIST, people were enamored with our PET scans. So were we. They're very dramatic. These PET scans are very dramatic pictures. It turns out, though, that in our routine practice, we don't use PET scans that much anymore. PET scans carry a lot more radiation to the patient, and they're a lot more expensive. I don't personally care about the cost that much because if it's better, if it's necessary, we do what's best for patients. But we don't really need that extra radiation. So our group has essentially gotten rid of PET scanning, as have most groups around the world, except in research studies occasionally, or except in using the PET scan to clarify further an ambiguous CT scan or MRI scan. And I think that's the important thing. I think a lot of doctors do a lot of PET scans. It's one of those things where our routine guidelines from the National Comprehensive Care Network, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, the NCCN, really emphasize that you don't need PET scans all the time. It's more radiation, it's more cost, and it doesn't really bring that much more to patients. I'm not trying to criticize your doctor. Your doctor may be doing it for a specific reason. But routine care here at Dana-Farber and other expert centers really doesn't have a big role for PET scanning. So I think that it's good that it's clear and that it doesn't show anything. So if anything, that's terrific. But I think you might want to discuss that a little bit more with the doctor and maybe spare a little bit of the radiation that the PET scan brings.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have one last question from one of our online participants. If a tumor has shrunk to about half, is radiation a help? That's a general question, so don't have all the details, but Dr. Dimitri, if you can answer it in any way, that would be helpful, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, radiation is just surgery without a knife in many ways, and it's not as good for GIST as surgery. So the truth here is, in general, we don't turn to radiation for much in this disease. The only time we tend to use radiation is if somebody has a painful GIST in a bone that is just causing enough pain, and bones are particularly difficult to take all of the tumor out, so that's the one time we use radiation against GIST. Otherwise, GIST tends to be relatively resistant to radiation, so if anything, if it's shrunk and there's a reason, we might consider taking it out with surgery rather than turning to radiation. And I guess that's all I would say. Again, the specifics matter always in these kinds of things. It matters where it is, whether somebody could do surgery, and whether it's even worth doing the surgery or just leaving it there and treating it medically. Those are the key questions. And that's a very common consultation we have at our expert center. Community doctors send that kind of patient to us so that we could then advise them about what to do in that situation.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been an outstanding team today. Just thank you so much. I want to thank all of our participants, those who have queued up and asked questions online and on the telephone, and all of you who have been listening. And in concluding, I just want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour workshop and that we know that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so we do want to really refer you to calling certainly LifeRaft Group with any medical questions you may have or need for help. And you have their information in your materials and also Cancer Care as well for any additional counseling or support you might need. And also, I do want to call out to all of you that on Sunday, July 13th, is GIST Awareness Day. And you have lots of material about that in your materials, but please do stay tuned for that. That's wonderful. It's a wonderful acknowledgement for GIST. It means that GIST has so much more awareness for the public. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.